Police say he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, but some are still demanding more review of a local teen's death. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, calls for an independent investigation into the death of Jacksonville teen Devin Gregory. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, one family's ordeal with MISC. It's a rare complication and a serious one for kids that's associated with COVID-19. We'll tell you about that later on. First, though, the latest on the pandemic. The State Department of Health reported 97 new deaths Monday and nearly 6,700 new cases of COVID around the state. Florida is right on the edge of topping 1 million cases of coronavirus, with a death toll at just above 18,500. And at the end of the month, Jacksonville was listed as one of the state's top five cities with confirmed cases of the virus. Miami, Orlando, Jacksonville, Tampa, and Hialeah, a suburb of Miami, have the most cases. In November alone, hospitalizations in the U.S. more than doubled from coronavirus. And in the U.S., we saw more deaths than the pandemic's combined death toll in Australia, Canada, China, Japan, and Germany. The bottom line is, this is very serious, so please continue to wear your masks, everyone. Well, in addition to the global pandemic, the other big story from this year has been the prominence of the Black Lives Matter movement. Activists have gotten louder and more insistent, calling for more transparency and accountability in examining the police shootings of Black Americans. A local incident is now receiving some national scrutiny. It began last month when four officers with JSO shot more than 30 rounds into a car they'd stopped on the west side. Officers say they opened fire into the vehicle after de-escalation tactics failed. They have been placed on administrative leave for the time being while the case is investigated. Police did release body cam footage of the shooting incident last week. According to JSO, the medical examiner ruled that a teenager inside, 18-year-old Devin Gregory, died not from the police fusillade of gunfire, but from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. However, increasingly outside groups are calling for an independent federal investigation into Devin Gregory's death. Leisha Brooks is chief of staff at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she's on the line with more. Leisha, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
What are your questions about the death of Jacksonville teen Devin Gregory? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open. So, Leisha, we have seen the body cam footage of this incident. It happened just before Thanksgiving at the intersection of San Juan and Cassett Avenues. 18-year-old Devin Gregory died. What's your reaction to JSO saying that it appears Devin died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound? If that is in fact the case, why still call for an independent investigation?
Well, let me first say that the Southern Poverty Law Center is just sending my thoughts and prayers to the family. 18 years old, and Devin Gregory was not with his family during the Thanksgiving holiday and won't be there for Christmas. So just let's just take a moment to take that in.
Sure.
And the Southern Poverty Law Center issued a statement calling for an investigation right after this incident occurred. We appreciate that the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office released the body cam footage, you know, within 48 hours. So we want to applaud and thank them for that. As we understand it, the medical examiner office said that there was a self-inflicted wound. As we understand it, we're not quite sure which was the deadly shot, whether it came from Mr. Gregory or whether it came from the 30 rounds that came from law enforcement.
Okay, so while that's still being investigated, share with our listeners what we do know about the incident, what led up to it and what happened during the incident and why police shot so many rounds.
Well, JSO has not yet released information as to why they pulled over the car. So it was just some kind of traffic infraction. We don't know what that was. The footage that we've seen is just, it's just heartbreaking. It's completely clear that this 18-year-old was frightened. He was scared. I want to applaud the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office officers who tried to de-escalate it, right? They tried to calm him down, and he just became increasingly agitated and frightened. And I think that this is very important for everyone to remember, that because there have been such a, outsized number of shootings by law enforcement of African-American men, that this has a traumatizing effect and impact on African-American men in particular. Research has showed that even one incident, one's awareness of one incident of misconduct or abuse is associated with, disorders that follow the individual, throughout their lifetime. So as we understand it, say, for instance, I'm aware of all of the police shootings of African Americans over the last year or so. Each subsequent shooting has a traumatic effect on me and will impact how I interact if I ever find myself in that situation. And you could just see that through the video and how increasingly frightened Devin Gregory became, even though law enforcement tried to assure him that he would be safe and that he would be going home. There's his talking about, tell my mom I love her, I love you. He knew he wasn't going home. And so that is just heartbreaking. In the face of officers telling him, no, it's going to be okay, you could see that he completely believed that he was going to die that night. And so just that alone deserves, a full investigation. I would say that the number of rounds that were shot into the car, we do understand that they responded to a shot in the car, but 30 rounds into a car is excessive by kind of anyone's measurement.
We're speaking with Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center about the death of Jacksonville teen Devin Gregory after a traffic stop at San Juan and Cassett last month led to gunfire. Give us a call, 549-2937. So we don't know for sure how Devin Gregory died, although as we've noted, the medical examiner believes he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Can I ask you your thoughts about how the Black Lives Matter movement has forced JSO and many other police agencies around the nation to be more transparent? We do have body cam footage of this incident. We would not have had that before. Mm-hmm. We do have increased scrutiny on these incidents. We would not have had that before. We do see police making a much more good faith attempt to engage with de-escalation tactics. We see that in the footage. That might not have happened before. So Black Lives Matter has made some impact in the way police interact with Black Americans, but it's an active, ongoing movement, and there are so many issues that have been highlighted within it. I guess I'd like to get your thoughts on where we are with all of this, given that some changes seem to have been made.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for lifting those positive changes up that can be and should be directly connected to the Black Lives Matter movement for Black Lives and people who have been activated, in the streets in response to deadly shooting upon deadly shooting. So, yes, we wouldn't have officers wearing body cams if it wasn't for the work that's been done on the ground by Black Lives Matter and Movement for Black Lives activists. We wouldn't have the medical examiner coming out so quickly with information, let alone the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office releasing that body cam footage so quickly. I would say, too, that the officers who did attempt to de-escalate the situation, it seemed that they had some sensitivity to what was going on, but certainly more needs to be done. I think it shows that the real continuing need for training and ongoing training for law enforcement I think it speaks to the need for other interventions with, you know, mental health professionals who can intervene in situations like this. I think it shows the need for just a continued look at policing. Policing, you know, is a social relationship that is between, you know, the officers and the communities that they serve. Then how they engage with the community should always be subject to shifts in sensitivities and learning. We should not have law enforcement agencies operating as they did, you know, a year ago, a month ago, as we hopefully learn from each of these tragic and deadly shootings. Law enforcement agencies and heads of law enforcement agencies and states, all of us should demand better. Let me also say that as we understand it, this was the first kind of officer-involved shooting for each of these officers. Imagine the impact on them too, right? So we're trying to save lives all the way around, from death and from traumatization.
Let's go to some calls now as we talk about the death of Jacksonville teen Devin Gregory. 549-2937 to join us. Kathy is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Kathy. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think you might have just addressed what my comment was, which was when you do watch the video, it looks like the police are trying very, very hard to calm Mr. Gregory down, but they were unable to. And he asked to be, he yelled at them for them to shoot him, and he also asked to be left alone, according to the news reports. So I was questioning whether or not they were adequately trained in de-escalation or dealing with someone who is clearly suicidal. So that was my comment, which I think you may have just talked about.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. You know, Leisha, the whole rallying cry, defund the police, which we heard a lot of this year, critics of that slogan have said that it's not an accurate representation of what activists are calling for, which is to reconstitute the role of the police, that police shouldn't be mental health therapists for the public, that they shouldn't, that mental health professionals should be brought in to deal with people who are clearly suffering, but that often police are the ones that are the frontline workers in that type of situation. So what are your thoughts about how this tragedy, this death of Devin Gregory, interacts with that whole movement to change the way our criminal justice system deals with mental health?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it offers another example of why law enforcement needs to partner with and work with trained mental health professionals. I can say here in Montgomery, Alabama, our police agency is beginning to work with mental health professionals and bring them with them on, you know, kind of driving and as they patrol around communities. I think it seems like there was enough time, say, that even if there was a mental health professional on call, it kind of like how they bring other crisis workers to the scene. They should be encouraged and allowed to bring on mental health professionals. Let me just say something to what Kathy raised around Mr. Gregory appearing suicidal. I want to go back to the point that I made earlier around the impact, the psychological impact, the devastating impact that these police-involved shootings of African-Americans have on African-Americans. I would not want to give the impression that Mr. Gregory was suicidal. I'm not a trained mental health professional, so just let me make that clear as well. But it seemed to me that he became increasingly scared and increasingly panicked as the law enforcement officers tried to talk to him. So I don't know that he entered the situation looking to have the officer shoot him. I think it was a result of the traumatization that exists for many African American males. He was 18 years old. He was a child.
And he had a firearm himself.
Right. Well, yeah, it was in the car. I don't know who it belonged to.
All right, Norman and Hilliard. Go ahead, Norman.
Yes, my comment, first of all, is what a tragedy for an 18-year-old to lose his life in this manner. But we lose focus of the big picture here. The police officers, and I've watched the video many times, the police officers tried their best to de-escalate the situation. At first, I thought this young man scared, but in the end, I've decided that, in my mind, I don't think that being scared was the issue. There was some other issue. You know, there's so much in the news about white officers shooting black men. There are an awful lot of white men that are shot also by police, unfortunately. We never address how these situations affect the police officers. I feel very sorry for these police officers who were put in a situation that ended so tragically. One other thing I'd like to make is the volley of 30 shots were not fired by one officer. The car was surrounded by police officers. There were probably 7 or 8 there. So once that shot rang out, the initial shot, the police officers did what they're trained to do. This particular body cam footage should be showcased by national media as, you know, here are the police officers doing the best they possibly can to not end up having to injure the suspect. Thank you.
All right. Leisha.
I appreciate that, and perhaps the caller missed when I acknowledged the trauma and stress that this caused the officers, as I understand this was their first police-involved shooting. So, yeah, the trauma happens there as well. Let me just also note that there's no competition between kind of people who are victimized by police violence who are shot by police. There's no competition relative to race. Let me also say that in terms of the de-escalation, I still assert that they could benefit from more training, that they tried to de-escalate it, and they were also kind of they were yelling, you know, they were, I don't know if their techniques helped or hurt the situation. And I have reviewed the video a couple of times too. So if they had adequate training around de-escalation, they might also be aware of the importance of them remaining calm.
Another point of view, here's an email from a listener. Cindy emails the show, can there be any explanation of what would warrant 30 rounds into an enclosed small space? I don't get this. Furthermore, how can you determine what is self-inflicted versus what is not, she says. Lots of calls, meanwhile. 549-2937. MW in Arlington. MW, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm an independent recording artist here in Jacksonville. I'm a black male, and I released a song, My Life Matters. I released it earlier this year. But my thing is, I understand where the other caller was coming from in reference to this may traumatize police officers and stuff. But my thing is, if you're never on this side of it, it's hard to understand. What warrants 30 rounds? I just don't understand that. And then you have this cycle of the police are put on leave. There's an investigation. Nothing happens. They're back on the job. There's a funeral. And it keeps going. What has warranted open season on black men other than the racist rhetoric that's been spewed over the last 4 years? I mean, it's just escalated to the point where you're afraid to even, if you see a police car coming, you're hoping that it goes by you because you just don't know. And that's unfair to have to live like that. No one should have to live like that. And that's where black men in America have gotten to, is to like, do I go home tonight if I get stopped? What is the deal? My life matters. And it ought to be, it's unfortunate that 18-year-old kid is no longer here. That's not right. I don't understand it, and it's hard to explain.
I want to thank you for sharing that. Thanks, MW. You know, Leisha, he really does articulate the perspective of Black men in particular in America and why this movement has become so powerful. And it's an active movement. It's still happening as we speak. It's not over.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate your comments too, MW. Thank you so much. And yeah, no one should have to live their life in fear that way. And if I could just speak to the point about the increased rhetoric over the last 4 years, and to say it under the Trump administration, the constant reference to Black men as thugs and as dangerous, and even in Black Lives Matter activists as terrorists or violent. This plays into it as well, whereby Black males are seen not as scared, not as children, but as a threat. And so we definitely need to acknowledge that that's true. We just celebrated or acknowledged the anniversary of the killing of Tamir Rice, who was not seen as a child. And this does need to stop, because no one, I have a son, no one should.
So, because we're coming up against a break, are you still calling for federal review of Devin Gregory's death?
Yes. It's a full and complete review.
Well, we'll follow the case, and I want to thank you, Leisha Brooks, with the Southern Poverty Law Center, Chief of Staff there. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more coming up. Meanwhile, later, dozens of local artists showcase their work in a new exhibit this month. We'll preview that. But up next.
It does start off looking like the flu, and then it kind of takes a downward spiral into the blood vessels, into the organs, and things like that.
It's a rare condition associated with COVID-19 striking kids. One St. John's County family's harrowing story. That's next. We'll be right back.
I'm David Luckin, station manager, 89.9 FM, and throughout this year, the news on WJCT has never been more vital. As we approach Giving Tuesday and together lift up the organizations that make our community healthy and vibrant, know that our commitment to you and your family has never been stronger. Delivering in-depth and timely reporting that not only keeps you connected, but unites us all as a community. We do everything we do for you. We couldn't do it without you. On this Giving Tuesday, make your voice heard for everyone in our community. Log on to WJCT.org or call 904-353-9528 to make your generous gift. Thank you.
Welcome back. Well, it's a rare but serious complication associated with COVID-19, multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Most people call it MIS-C. Now, this is a condition where parts of the body become inflamed, including vital organs. We don't know what causes this, but doctors say many kids with MIS-C also had the virus that causes COVID. This week, I spoke with a St. John's County mother, Katie. Her 16-year-old son, Merritt, who was perfectly healthy, was in the ICU for almost a week with a very serious condition, and she has a message for parents. Take a listen. Hi, Katie. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks. And I'm curious to hear about your family situation. So you have a 16-year-old son, Merritt, who came down with what is known as MISC, or multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. Tell us about what happened to your son.
So my son is 16 years old. He's about 6'4", tall kid, about 145 pounds, tall glass of water, very athletic kid, healthy kid, never has had any underlying health issues to speak of, goes to the doctor, the pediatrician, maybe once a year for his wellness checkup for sport physicals and things like that. Overall, a very healthy kid. So this was something that we never expected or was never really on our radar. Also, we have been very cautious with COVID-19. We've been a little bit more complacent with putting our children back to school, keeping them from activities and mm-hmm. things like that. So we were taking all the precautions that my husband and I with our family that we thought, you know, were necessary and needed. What had happened with Merritt was he came home not feeling well, figured, you know what, Mom, I think I just ate a bad sub or something. The mayonnaise was kind of funky. I don't know what's wrong. I'm like, okay. Stomach was upset. Woke up in the middle of that night vomiting, and then diarrhea started. So I thought, okay, maybe food poisoning. Had no other symptoms, was not feeling ill or anything like that prior to. So we kind of chalked it up like, all right, maybe just a little bad sub. I don't know. So as that continued on into the next day, I was convinced this wasn't a bad sub. This was something else going on, because then he started having a little bit of a fever, a mild fever, nothing crazy, 99, you know, 98, 99, enough to where you're like, ooh, maybe you picked up something. Let's get you COVID tested. Obviously, right now, that's the first thing, top of mind. Everybody thinks, yes, it's COVID. So we took him to a rapid response COVID place. It was on the weekend. It was on a Sunday. He was negative to that. So we thought, okay. And now we do understand that those aren't 100% accurate, but at least it gave us kind of a peace of mind of, all right, well, the chances of it being COVID are a little bit less. So let's watch this and see. It seemed like he just picked up a flu bug of some sort. So he continued vomit and diarrhea probably every 6 to 8 hours, as the flu would be, you know, little bit of a fever. So we were treating it at the house like a flu, you know, plenty of fluids, getting him, you know, Gatorade when he could, and staying on top of that as much as we could, but not thinking too much more than just that. That continued on to the second day, and there was he just wasn't letting up. There wasn't any let up where, you know, if you have children with the flu, there's some sort of corner that you turn a little bit. Maybe the vomiting backs off, maybe the diarrhea backs off, maybe there's a break in the fever, but it just seemed to keep escalating. His fever kept rising a little bit. He kept vomiting and diarrhea around like clockwork every 6 hours. So that was really concerning to me. Also, he had a very strange look in his eyes. It's hard to explain, but you know your kid, and you know your kid when they're sick, but this was something different. The whites of his eyes were starting to be really red, like bloodshot almost. And that's where I thought, well, maybe that's from vomiting. You know, sometimes when you're throwing up a lot, you break blood vessels in your eyes and it's a strain, but it wasn't too alarming at that point. As far as I had no idea what MIS-C was at this point. Never had heard of it, never had thought of it. In my mind, he didn't have COVID, so this is the flu. So we continued to monitor him. In the top of day three, I just felt like he was lethargic. He was having trouble standing, very dizzy. The dehydration, I could tell, was starting to set in because it was impossible to keep up with getting the fluids in. He was continually throwing up and diarrhea.
Wow.
You know, he was losing
terrifying
like
as a
that.
Mom, I would think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I took him. Fortunately, we have a wonderful pediatrician around the corner from our house, 3 miles up the road. And I took him there, and she looked at him right away and was like, whoa, this kid's very sick. He's having trouble sitting up. He's severely dehydrated. She did a flu swab of his nose, and that came back negative.
So at that point, I was pretty concerned because now it's not COVID. It's not flu. What is going on with my son? So I took him to the ER. His blood pressure was dropping. That was a huge concern and a huge red flag for the doctors and myself was why is this healthy child, you know, relatively healthy child without any underlying health issues? What is up with the blood pressure falling? They were aware of what MISC was. They've had maybe 5 or 6 cases in the Jacksonville area at Wilson. So it's new, but it wasn't like so brand new to them.
Can you explain whether or not your son contracted MIS-C because he was also at the same time exposed to COVID-19?
So how they are connected is then they tested him for the antibodies once he was in the hospital. And that test takes a little bit longer time to get the result. It takes about a day to get the result. So we were waiting on that. Once they had the result that, yes, he had the COVID-19 antibodies, then they shifted gears towards, wow, this is probably MIS-C, because what they're finding is that the MIS-C is a syndrome of COVID-19. So what they believe is that he was exposed to COVID-19 probably 2 or 3 months ago, asymptomatic, was never sick, never had any issues with it. So he had the antibodies for COVID in his system. This MISC is basically a syndrome where your immune system goes into overdrive, from what I understand, and kind of attacks the antibodies and creates this inflammation of the blood vessels, which can also affect the organs, lungs, kidneys, heart, brain. There's a whole list. There's not a lot of information out right now because this is fairly new, but it is a syndrome of COVID-19. So he was exposed to COVID-19 probably a few months ago, but as I said, tested negative. Had a syndrome.
So the good news is that your son is on the mend, but it's been a difficult road to get him better. He spent
8 days in the ICU. 8 days, and he was considered what they call a minor quote-unquote case, which my husband and I are like, are you kidding me? Because he didn't have underlying health issues. Some of the cases that they're seeing, these children have maybe kidney failure or have to be on a ventilator or things like that. My son, his heart, and I don't want to say the word only, but was the only organ that was really affected and under attack. Which was a major one for sure, but he didn't have the list that they could have that they have been seeing because he was a very healthy child going into it. His health is what kept him from having a more critical case. So his heart was what the inflammation was pretty much centralized in his heart. So once they keyed in on that and gave him the IVIG, they put a PICC line in his heart and was able to, I mean, they, like I said, were one step ahead of it and had this wonderful protocol that they followed, and his body fought and reacted. And he is now home. He came home the day before Thanksgiving, which we were oh so grateful.
Oh, that's great.
It was wonderful, but he spent 8 days in the ICU, which they were amazing. All of the doctors, all of the nurses, watching every little move, every little tick, and making sure he was going the direction they wanted to. But it was something that flipped our world in an instant for a child, flipped our community. I mean, the outpouring of love that we've had, support from his friends and his teammates from the sports he plays and and where he works in the community, because it's like, wait a minute, this is a really healthy kid. This is like, this kid was so healthy. This family drinks green juice. Like, they're really healthy.
Right. So Katie, then what lessons do you think we can draw from your son's ordeal and the little that we know right now about this condition?
Well, that's what I'm kind of trying to create some awareness for, because the lessons would be just err on the side of caution. Don't ever feel like you're being a little crazy, you know, taking them to the ER or something like that, because there's something about that gut intuition. And, you know, I have been asked, like, how did you know? How did you know to take him? And there was just something off with him. But I just, this time, it's just heightened awareness of erring on the side of caution, taking them to the ER, asking for a flu test in addition to a COVID test. You know, if the COVID test is negative, get a flu test too to see, because it does start off looking like the flu. It starts off looking exactly like the flu. And then it kind of takes a downward spiral into the blood vessels, into the organs and things like that. The rapidness, I have to say, of this syndrome that we saw in our son is what is scary to me. Within 36 hours, he went from going to volleyball practice, diddy bopping through the house, healthy, happy teenager, to the ICU in 36 hours. That is something that I'm trying to promote to parents. Err on the side of caution. Get him to the pediatrician or get him to the ER. Look for signs, you know, their eyes. That was the big thing with Merritt that I noticed, his, you know, the redness around in the white parts of his eyes, because that was, you know, his blood vessels and things like that. He was having inflammation. So looking back a week and a half ago, I had no idea what MISC was.
Now we know.
Well, this is very real.
You know, I'm so glad that he's going to be all right. And I want to thank you for sharing this story with our listeners. It's really vital information that parents everywhere need to know about. Thank you so much, Katie, for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, we've all been worried about keeping our kids healthy during this time. That includes their mental health, for young kids and newborns, too. Chris Lester is co-chair of the North Florida chapter of the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health, and they have a Zoom get-together this week. Take a listen.
Hi, Chris. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you, Melissa.
So you have an inaugural meeting coming up for this new organization, the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health, the local chapter of this. This is fascinating because I think most new parents, they're just so worried about their babies surviving physically that they might not stop and think about this equally important aspect of their health, their infant well-being mentally and behaviorally. So can I begin by asking you about this field of study? Tell me more about the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health.
Well, Melissa, the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health has been around for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And actually, Northeast Florida had one of the most vibrant chapters in the early years. And so we're really revitalizing what is already here. Our region enjoys a very robust number. We have over 30 child-serving agencies who focus on maternal and newborn and infant care. So we have quite a wide range of opportunities to support. And specifically what we do is we promote education on the effects of mental, emotional, and social development during infancy.
And you expect some 20,000 babies to be born in our region this year. So
isn't that amazing? Yes.
Yeah. So lots of new babies coming to our community. What's the message for people who really don't know a lot about this topic? They tend to think of feeding the baby, making sure the baby gets changed, gets sleep. But mental health, particularly in this community, is not up to par. We're one of the least funded and resourced communities in a state that's also near the bottom when you talk about mental and behavioral health. What can we be doing as a society to focus on this earlier with newborns and little ones rather than waiting till they're older and of school age?
Well, you ask such an important question. And what we believe in our organization is that the professional development initiatives for the infant and the family workforce is a crucial strategy to support that foundational early learning and early development of our babies. So, you know, we know that so much of the baby's development happens during pregnancy and in those first few months, kind of that fourth trimester, if you will. So certainly what we can do is broaden our view to encompass all of mental, emotional, and social development, and to really support our families who are in transition from pregnancy to parenting. We have a very strong support system for labor and delivery. You know, our women get 24 hours care, as you know. You get quite a bit of support. And that structure then moves away after the baby's born. And so we really want to bridge and help, help support families in that transition from pregnancy to parenting, and also to help the workforce that that supports them. So our infant care providers, our child care providers, and the agencies that I mentioned that provide services.
Yeah. So this Friday, December 4th, you are facilitating the locals chapter's first Zoom meeting, and this is open to anyone with an interest in maternal infant well-being. Tell us what's on the agenda.
Yeah. So we are going to have, as you mentioned, a facilitated Zoom session, and I'll be the facilitator. And so what we're offering our community, and this is open to anyone, any individual who's interested in maternal, newborn, infant well-being, and you do not have to be a member of the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health. We welcome everyone. And what I promise to your listeners, Melissa, is that we're going to offer content and connection. And our content, I'm so happy to share this with you. We have one of our local chapter members, Jenny Bowden, and she is a licensed mental health counselor. She is going to share with us content about how to support families in transition from pregnancy to parenting, especially in the area of postpartum depression, prenatal depression, and anxiety. So Jenny is going to give us resources and information and very specific advice and guidance about how we can support. We know that at least 20% of women who give birth experience some level of depression or anxiety. And honestly, Melissa, I personally believe and professionally believe that that number is very low. I believe there's a very low self-report rate, and a lot of times we say, well, it's just the baby blues, or, you know, it's sleep deprivation, and you're a mom, I'm a mom.
Yeah.
We know what that's like when we bring that baby home from the hospital and go, oh my gosh. But so I do feel that that's underreported, and also dads get postpartum depression as well, at least 10%. So Jenny's going to help inform us and give us specific resources and free resources that are available so that our caregivers and our others who are supporting families will have resources to go to. And then we're also going to talk about some of the other educational initiatives that the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health is sponsoring.
This is coming up Friday morning. How can people join?
So people can go to the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health website, which the organization is called FAIMH, F-A-I-M-H, so they can go to FAIMH.org, and perhaps, I think you're going to have that link on your website as well, correct, for events?
We should, yes. So check it out online, and again, this is Friday morning. She's Chris Lester, co-chair of the North Florida chapter of the Florida Association for Infant Mental Health. Join them virtually this Friday morning. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we'll be right back.
Conductor Thomas Wilkins returns to Jacksonville to lead the symphony in Tchaikovsky's beautiful Serenade for Strings. Written in the model of his great idol Mozart, the Serenade for Strings is still filled with Tchaikovsky's hallmark romanticism. The images it projects are rich, deep, abstract, and enduring. The program also features Poulenc's wonderful Sinfonietta, December 4th and 5th in physically distanced Jacobi Symphony Hall. For tickets and information, visit jacksymphony.org.
I'm David Luckin, station manager, 89.9 FM. Giving Tuesday is here, a day when people all over the world give to organizations making a difference in their lives and communities. And all that generosity, it really adds up. If donating to WJCT News is something you can do, then don't wait. Give for the first time today and join the global movement for giving back. Here's how to make a big impact this Giving Tuesday. Visit WJCT.org/donate and thank you.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Rapid COVID-19 testing may help life get back to some kind of normal. One New York City restaurant is testing that idea by requiring employees and guests to test negative before they're allowed into the dining room. Can rapid testing save nightlife? That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Joe Biden says he'll tackle climate change and stimulate the economy. The price tag? $2 trillion. Rejoining the Paris Agreement will be step one. But what new ideas are behind his push to decarbonize the country? And can we be sure this will be money well spent? Biden's climate change plan, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, dozens of local artists are showcasing their work in a new exhibit this month. Jennifer Wolf with Women Writing for a Change told me about their anthology release this weekend.
Jennifer Wolf, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Melissa. It's a pleasure.
So tell us about the release of this second anthology that you have coming out in December. What's happening?
Well, we're very excited to introduce the second edition of A River Rising, Anthology of Women's Voices, which is a collection of writing and art from the artists and writers, women artists and writers of Jacksonville. And it represents the work that is based on the themes that we've had for our art shows in 2019 and 2020. So this theme is birds, which was the fall of 2019 art exhibit, and the spring was bloom. And so we just had no idea that in 2020, what would be blooming would be the coronavirus and a massive wave of protests over the death of George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot to say in this anthology.
Well, yeah, what will people be able to take in?
Well, so the work, the anthology represents the works of over 85 different writers and artists. We have each semester when we have our art shows, we have about 40 or 45 artists from the general community and as well as featured artists that we've specifically invited. So we will see their works on the theme of birds and blooms. And then as writers, we respond to that art through specifically classes that we've taken that are based on the themes, but also the themes of birds and blooms are themes that regularly show up in our writing in general, because we're, as women writers, we are always concerned about the environment and how to create safe habitats for our communities.
So with all of that said, when is all this going to be unveiled and how can we participate?
Well, the launch party will be December 5th at San Marco Bookstore and in the San Marco Square from 12 to 2. And we will have copies available for people to pre-order and pick up or buy there. And that will be a masked and socially distanced event. So everyone will need to follow their protocols there. And to spread out the crowd a little bit, we're having a second opening at Tara Wise Homes the next day in Springfield, again from 12 to 2. And then Sunday afternoon, we'll have a giant Zoom call read-around with as many artists and writers and their fans as we can get on Zoom together. And we will read to the community what is in the anthology. So it's really a celebration of women's voices and their perspective on the issues that are very current in our lives right now.
Excellent. And go to Jennifer's website, womenwritingjacksonville.org, for more about this anthology, Lifting Up Women's Voices. Jennifer Wolf of Women Writing for Change, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
And today is Giving Tuesday, a global movement where people put their dollars where they think they will do the most good. Your support makes a difference as you make your gift. Wherever you do it today, we want you to consider becoming a monthly sustainer here at WJCT. You guys are a special group of reliable monthly donors who play a key role in providing the First Coast with everything from access to early childhood education, critical news and information, inspiring stories, music from around the world, captivating dramas, and civil discourse that moves this community and this country forward. It is easy to participate in Giving Tuesday by making a one-time or a monthly donation to WJCT.org. That's right. We are a nonprofit and we are listener and viewer supported. $15 a month, $180 a year are our most popular giving levels. If you can contribute as much as $100 a month, you qualify for our First Coast Society and you will be in very good company because I know some of those fine folks. So go to wjct.org/donate and make your donation on this Giving Tuesday. We so appreciate it. And if you search that hashtag on social media, Giving Tuesday, you'll find a number of other ways that you can support, you name it, any cause that strikes your fancy this holiday season. And in this pandemic and recession, Giving Tuesday, you know, it's become more vital than ever. There are so many people in this community at risk of eviction, at risk of going hungry, having to go to food banks, people that have never done that before. It's been such a difficult year. So if you are in a position to help, just do what you can. And when you do it, share your donation on social media. Use that hashtag Giving Tuesday. And thanks. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. They go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.